Hello and welcome back to ELT Under the Covers. Today we have a new guest, but before we introduce this esteemed guest, we're going to do our own little introductions. So I'm Neil of Teen Teacher Fame, and I'm today joined by my co-host,
Relentless Rich. Just telling it like it is, as always.
Exactly.
So that's all I've got today, unless you want to make a Krispy Kreme joke.
No, we'll keep those for the React videos. So today we have the former course director of the Oxford TEFL Trinity Dip TESL course, the Princess of Prawn, the teacher development alchemist, EdTech consultant, writer, dabbler in and of the English language teaching world, the marvelous Nicola Meldrum. Welcome to the show.
Hello. How many syllables in this word? How many syllables? How many syllables?
Two.
Okay. Which is the correct stress? Dada, dada, or dada? Is it cabbage? Cabbage or cabbage?
Cabbage.
Yes.
What an intro. Thank you for having me. Delighted to be here.
Thank you very much. We're delighted to have you. So we like to start these interviews, these little chats, where we first delve into, as Jamie coined it, the origin stories of these teachers, because we all have these different routes, depending on your accent, to where we got to today. So can you dial back the clock and let us know how you started and walk us through how you become Nicola Meldrum of today?
Become all of those things. Well, it all started when I was working in a bar in Edinburgh, and I'd just come back from a year away traveling around Australia, and I was looking out the window feeling very fed up, looking at the rain and the grey skies. And one of my colleagues was all excited because she was going off to Berlin to do a TEFL course, and I'd never really heard of this before. It's like, what's that? And so she told me all about it, and then she went off and did her course and came back, and I was still working in the bar, and she came back all qualified and then left and went to become an English teacher. So I started thinking about this as an option to help me escape from rainy Edinburgh, and looked at a few courses, picked Oxford TEFL in Barcelona, and went off and did my TEFL course with the intention of going to South America because I'd never been there before. Thinking, well, I'll just be one of those backpacker teachers. And I ended up kind of getting a job in Barcelona and finding a nice flatmate, and everything just fell into place, and it's a very easy, comfortable place to live.
Yeah.
And back then there were lots and lots of jobs in teaching English, and I found that I really enjoyed it. And it helped me to meet lots of people in the city as well. So it's a great way, as you know, to kind of get into being in a place. And 2 years later, I was still there and teaching English, and then 3 years. And then I decided to get my diploma because I thought I wanted to be a better teacher. Mm-hmm. I suppose it's a reason why a lot of people do the diploma after teaching for a few years. They kind of they hit a plateau. I don't know if that happened to you. You get a bit...
So you went from just doing the just basic kind of course and then into the diploma. No, like in between, no CELTA or.
Yeah. I went. Why I went to. So originally I went to Barcelona to do the Oxford TEFL CERT-TESOL.
Oh, okay.
They were doing the Trinity CERT-TESOL course. So I did my 4-week course there and got a job.
Right.
And then 3 years later, I went back and did the diploma.
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of on the back of that, finished the diploma on the Friday, and they were desperate for teacher trainers on the dips. They're like, do you want to, on the CERT-TESOL.
Yeah.
So then I was qualified to start tutoring, and I started that. And then did that for years, kind of did a bit of seasonal cert TESOL tutoring and then moved on and teaching English, mostly in companies, but a bit of everything. And then moved on to working on the diploma and then kind of started being a full-time teacher trainer. So that's my very concise and short origin story.
It's I mean, it's incredibly challenging, I think, tutoring teachers. I've only done a little bit myself. I trained on the TILEC with the British Council, but I never actually went on and did a course that was like my final year with them. And I think there's lots of sort of challenges with it. Presumably you found that at the time, I guess, because you'd been teaching for what, like 5 years when you first started tutoring on the cert. So it must have been quite a step up from, you know, other things, I suppose. There's lots to learn about, you know, giving feedback to teachers and stuff like that.
Yeah, I suppose it's like any job. You when you start it, you're all fresh-faced and energetic and, you know, kind of getting on with it. And then you learn on the job. I think it's something that you learn a lot as you do it. You learn what works, what doesn't work. You mess up and you get better at managing feedback. It's a lot about managing people. It's a really tough course, and I found that what I did learn was that, you know, you really need to help people just get through their days sometimes.
Yeah,
it's quite draining, it's quite exhausting.
Yeah.
But I think you develop some amazing skills by doing that job.
I think just off the top of my head, what you're talking about now, one of the things that Neil mentioned before is he was talking about like when you're kind of steering, or not steering, but when you're kind of giving feedback to someone, like how you kind of work out what's going to work for an individual teacher, like what, you know, what you kind of say to someone, oh, maybe you could try this. And kind of also the idea of how well teachers can identify the things that they need and how much guidance they need, you know, because as teachers, we know this with students that, you know, sometimes what students think they want is not necessarily what they need or something exactly. Like that, right?
Yeah, and I think the typical model of, so how do you think it went today, and kind of like drawing out a lot of reflection, also puts a lot of pressure on the candidates and the developing teachers, I think sometimes too much. And I think it's something that I learned over the years, was balancing kind of just telling people and showing people and demonstrating a lot more in feedback, instead of doing that kind of like, so, you know, how do you think the lesson went today? And I kind of balanced that with a lot of other techniques and learned that that wasn't always the best route to kind of helping people develop. But it's also really important, because if you don't develop that skill of reflecting on your lessons, you can just be stuck with the same problems and same solutions all the time. So I think you kind of learn to kind of tackle it in different ways. And it depends on the person, it depends on how the lesson went and how big the issues were, or what room there is for development. Sometimes you spot little gaps and opportunities to push people in different ways, and then what's the best way to do that. So yeah, I think it is a matter of experience, and also, you know, there was a bit of development for us as well as tutors. Mm-hmm. We had sessions where we kind of looked at different ways of giving feedback and feeding back on a lesson, not just kind of doing feedback. I think, oh, let's do feedback now. Well, what does that mean? It can mean that whole reflective thing, or it can mean like, let's role play this situation, or let's redo this in this way, and let's all reorganize the board in this way, or reteach it in a different way. So you kind of, yeah. You need to look into that as well, as if you're starting out as a tutor, try and look at all the different tools in your toolkit.
Yeah, it's like a big sandbox, a play box that you're kind of playing around with things. It's really interesting the way you describe it. It's almost like you have like a mental map of kind of where you you kind of feel like people need to explore, or they're positioned themselves maybe a bit too far over to the top left. So we're gonna kind of move a little bit them over that way. It's really quite interesting, because one of the things that Rich always brings up when he talks about you, because I don't know if many people know this, that Nicola is the Jedi Master to Padawan Rich. And he always mentions that you pushed him, cajoled him at knife point to task-based learning, trying out one of those classes. And now he's completely in love with doing that sort of thing. I wondered if you can recollect, what was missing from, not missing from Rich, but probably missing from Rich. We know what he's like. to think, well, why, maybe he should try some task-based learning.
I mean, I found some of his lesson plans the other day stored on my computer from years ago. So I think I actually used them as examples for the following year.
Oh, wow.
Like little segments of them, like how to write good aims. So I think probably I felt he was ready for the challenge. It's like when you're doing the diploma, if you do the Trinity diploma, you teach 5 lessons in total, and 4 of them are observed and assessed by your kind of Oxford TEFL or your provider tutors. And so there's an opportunity there to kind of get observed and get loads of feedback on something new, as well as playing it safe and just passing and getting a good mark.
Right.
So maybe he was in that position of kind of being ready to do something new and different, and doing quite well. So he'd be,
I think that sounds quite accurate. I mean, not trying to toot my own horn or whatever, but I think, like, if I had gone there and it would have just been, I'll just do the lessons to get my pass or whatever and not worry about it, I don't think it would have been as memorable at all. Whereas coming away from it in the way that we did, because I seem to remember there was a number of things you did actually which made it a bit more challenging. Because one of the things was that the class was highly differentiated. I think that the class that we were teaching, like the range of levels was somewhere between pre-intermediate and upper intermediate. So it was covering kind of 3 different levels. And again, I come away from that thinking that that was sort of the standard. But since then, I don't think it is. I think that different dips can have classes with less of that in the class. So I was quite appreciative for that, because that obviously gave us an opportunity to really dive into like differentiating materials and stuff like that. So I thought that those elements of challenge actually made it a much more useful and instructive process. Although, as normal, those kind of things kind of can rub up against assessment in a kind of negative way, and John Kay was had a bit of a talk about that actually, how assessment can sort of unfortunately get in the way of how people develop sometimes. But I mean, that sounds about right to me, and I think that's what teacher training should be about.
Exactly. But it's 2 things. There's opportunities for development, and if you want to just focus on development, maybe a qualification is one thing that you do, but you've got to accept that with that comes assessment, and so there's going to be limitations, because if you're getting assessed, there have to be criteria that you're assessed against, and that puts limitations on immediately, doesn't it? That means that you've got to kind of meet and pass those criteria, but there's always room for personalization and development that suits that person, and everyone wants to, the other people have years ago when Dogme was in vogue, I remember somebody wanting to do their diploma lessons following that approach. And we found a way around it, it was great and it was hard, but he managed to kind of write the lesson plan in a different way and approach the class, and he passed. He did really well.
Yeah. Yeah, I've spoke to people about that in the past, actually, because I always wondered about that, how you would, because, people still rave about Dogme, and, it's a big thing. And you know, I kind of understand it and use elements of it, but I've never actually gone in and just done a dogme class just like, you know, just completely like that, not to those kind of specifications of it anyway. And I have spoke to people about it, and they've said that, you know, it is possible. It actually requires, if anything, more of a plan for the diploma, because you have to write all these if this, then this, if this, then this kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It's interesting as well with doing the dip, that you would mention that people were just playing it safe to get the dip and maybe not challenging themselves. But I always, in my mind, considered doing the dip would be to take that challenge to move your teaching to the next level. Because I think there's a general consensus of, you know, when you do the CELTA and they do a lot, they focus quite heavily on the PPP, and a lot of teachers, that's kind of their default setting. Then I feel like if you are doing the dip, then you should be starting to go and move away from that kind of formula to do the task-based learning, to do the dogma, to do that sort of thing, and really kind of, I guess, personalize your teaching and kind of find a way to be who you are as a teacher, rather than trying to confine yourself all the time to this format that works. Because if you don't, we don't get the Jamie Keddies of the world. We don't get these John Kay poetry lessons and such.
Exactly. Yeah, totally. I think there's two things. There's the development that happens on the course, and some of the best development comes through the projects, and there you can really choose things that will make an impact on your specific context and goals and interests. And you could you're just trying things out all the time anyway, because you've got a new module on this, and then you kind of are integrating new things. Mm. And then there's the teaching practice, which is the assessment. And I think that's where there's a balance of, you don't want to play it too safe and just do bog standard PPP lessons. Even if you do them really well, you have to show a bit more variety than four grammar PPP lessons. But you don't want to push yourself too far out of the comfort zone that it all kind of falls apart and doesn't go well. You have to be confident that what you're doing is going to work for those learners. And I think that's what the Trinity Dip is good for. The starting point for all the planning is not an approach or a method or try this out or a language analysis. It's who are the learners in the room and what do they need and want?
Right. That always gets lost.
Right, okay.
Yeah, that tends to get lost when teachers are thinking about teacher development, or we're talking about it. It's not about developing as a teacher per se. It's more, how can you be a better tool for these learners? So that's a really interesting take.
Yeah. And it was really interesting when we jumped online last year, that kind of got lost a bit, because everyone turned the mirror around and just started looking at themselves again, because they were so terrified of teaching online and being assessed online. It became like a really teacher-centered process again. And we had to kind of do some work as tutors to kind of think, right, how can we get people looking at the learners again? And putting them at the heart of the whole process again.
What did that involve?
It involved just kind of going back to basics a little bit. And I think when COVID hit and everything went online, there was so much stuff around that was all, use this tool. What tools can we use? What tech can we use to solve this problem?
Yeah.
And the baby got thrown out with bathwater massively, mm-hmm. and people got really distracted even panicked. But I don't know if you remember, there were like hundreds of posts every day on LinkedIn, on Instagram, on all social media. It was like, here's a new tool for using on Zoom.
I think there's a lot of things, isn't there? Because I mean, there's a whole bunch of teachers who struggle with technology. you know, I know I've got a couple of friends at British Council Valencia, and they have, in general, they have quite a sort of older teaching staff because people stay there a long time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they haven't got a clue when it comes to like using computers and stuff, or let's say they find it very challenging, you know. And I think it was really, you know, just getting over the technology hurdle was difficult for them. And in an ideal scenario, you know, you wouldn't necessarily push, you know, that style of teacher, someone who's, you know, spent most of their career not really working much with technology, and they've got all kind of other tools in their toolbox, and then suddenly you're like, okay, now sit in front of a laptop and do it that way. And I think that was, yeah, that'd be very challenging. And lots of things got thrown up about online teaching. I have to say, Nicola, one of the things that I was a bit surprised at was I had a look at a few conferences that were going on sort of after the pandemic, you know, and I kind of thought, oh wow, you know, I wonder what they're talking about. I wonder what's going on in teacher development now. It must have like started this revolution of, and I went and had a look, and it was like the same stuff like pre-pandemic. It was like they're talking about the same, how to engage learners, and you know, this kind of, just these general things. And I was like, really? Like, has this situation not inspired something different? You know, I wanted to hear about something weird and unusual that you can do with this specific situation that we've got now, right?
Mm. Yeah, I think there was like extremes, wasn't there? There was the kind of going back to, like, carrying on with the same old thing, and then the kind of shiny new buttons and toys that were available and how we could make better use of them to teach English. And I think one of the main challenges that came out that wasn't really addressed in conferences is how to start your own, not your own company, but how to, a lot of people lost their jobs.
Yeah,
and suddenly it just had to start kind of fending for themselves and teaching online and going back to, and there was very little talk on like the practicalities of how do you set yourself up to be a teacher on your own, or working for one of those big companies, or form, what are the alternatives? Could we form cooperatives? Could we do this? There wasn't a lot of energy into the practical side of it, which was a bit of a shame.
Agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, and
I was actually in that situation because I was looking for kind of jobs in my area in like academic management. That was my plan at the time. I was like, right, I've done all this tutoring at the British Council. Now I'll kind of go into, you know, some director of studies job or something like that. And I was actually going for job interviews for exactly that, just when everything hit in like the end of February. And obviously I think I'd actually had a couple of conditional offers, and then they were all like, like, we're not hiring now. And you know, shortly after that, they probably, as you say, there was probably people who lost their jobs. So suddenly, you know, it was this kind of like, oh, well, I'm going to have to change my plan then. And I kind of went through that. I got very lucky actually, because I'm working with a very, very nice company that's working well for me. I got lucky with that. Because I did experience what you're talking about with those bigger platforms. You know, there's just massive platforms. It's like the eBay of teaching, isn't it? You go on there, you put up your profile, you kind of market yourself, you know, and you're competing against, you know, somebody who's charging €7 an hour and someone who's been on the platform for 10 years is right at the top of the pile and is charging whatever, you know, funny amounts of money an hour. And they've got all the ratings and they've got everything set up. So it's a very, very kind of competitive and a very intimidating place to be if you've been, you know, you've been a teacher for like over a decade or even, you know, more. Some people, you know, teaching for 20, 25 years or something, and then suddenly they're thrown into that where it's like, what, I have to like compete with people who don't even have a teaching qualification. You know, they just go online and do conversation classes and get good ratings or whatever. So I think there should definitely have been more discussion about that.
It's a big shift, isn't it? Because then what is a good English teacher? What's a popular English teacher? Is it going like politics, where it's like identity teaching? People who are more charismatic and popular and better at social media, self-marketing, like become more successful. It's quite interesting how that's going to maybe change things, or is changing things.
Yeah, and then there's the elements of the gatekeepers as well, because before you could do private tutoring one-to-one and you set it up, you meet through, you know, language exchanges and stuff like that, or, you know, you have a post in the local classifieds or what have you. But now you have to go through this larger website and put yourself up for sale. Or, you know, you go to these companies, you know, like Magic Ears or VIP Kids, especially, and then you have to teach in their style. You know, some people argue that it's basically you are given a PowerPoint presentation. They've got that. It's not about you as a teacher. It's about their system, and people buy into the system. So do they even need a qualified teacher as well? So there's a whole lot of way of people having to deal with that. And the ones that I found that have dealt the best with this so far are those that are already started to come up with their own brand as a teacher. So those that have already been teaching and doing videos of their lessons or of doing lessons on YouTube that people are like, oh, I think I like this teacher. His style works with me. I'm going to see if he does private lessons. I mean, you know, this helped with Professor Rich. You know, we get a bunch of people coming through for Team Teacher, but as well, but you know, it doesn't interest me as much. But and then also these international lines as well, because we're starting to realize that we have different ecosystems in different countries that don't always intermix. When we kind of think of the internet as, you know, one unified world, and I'm always getting questions through Team Teacher China that, well, I want to teach these some people in China, and they're like, well, but I can't do that because, you know, they don't have YouTube, they don't have Twitter. How do I get in touch with them? Oh, you've got to download WeChat. Okay, then how do I communicate with these people through WeChat? And it's not just that. It's, you know, Korea has Kakao Talk. You know, no one uses people will use WhatsApp, but Kakao Talk is the main messaging social media ecosystem. So it's navigating all of that terrain as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because you're right. I was trying to when we were working last summer, and
but Russia has VK.
Yeah.
No one knows about that.
There's everything's banned. So trying to work with teachers in Saudi Arabia who were doing the DIP teaching practice, and then their VPN, it became quite complicated. But it's interesting. I was speaking to Duncan Ford at Oxford TEFL the other day because he was asking me about the Innovate conference they're going to run again this year. And the theme is kind of facing forward, I think. I hope I get that right. And I suggested that he has a thread on this because, you know, you have the normal things that you were saying, Rich, like the young learners thread or track, whatever you want to call it, English track, the professional development track, whatever it is. It's like your special interest groups, i.e. TEFL. Like, what we
how
need
to
is
feedback,
like...
feedback, how to correct...
Yeah, we need a business track. We need a track that helps people kind of set up on their own or be able to navigate this world that we're in now. And be able to kind of, you know, talk about the fact that the ELT is, it's a job. And there is all this kind of practical business side to it that we need to be a bit savvier about, I think. So hopefully
agree with that.
He's going to hopefully put together some kind of tracks, and maybe you guys can can help with that.
It would be very, very interesting. Yeah, and you know, it's something that I think has actually been, even before the pandemic, I think it's something that was a bit of a problem. And I remember coming across some literature in the DIP. I don't remember who exactly was talking about it, but it was definitely some mention of like how... might have been Duncan, actually. there was definitely some mention of how, like, the practicalities of, you know, what teachers are expected to do often doesn't get taken into consideration when we're talking about all this CPD and stuff, you know, continued professional development. It's like you're expecting teachers to, you know, have this incredible passion to improve themselves as a teacher. And, you know, hopefully they do, but the other side of it is, you know, if they're working somewhere where they're getting paid like 9 or 10 euros an hour, then, you know, maybe they're not going to spend, you know, 15 hours a week of their own time, like working on all this reflection and stuff, you know. So there
are
some
it doesn't take into account the full the full realm and spectrum of teachers. And that's one of the things that we really wanted to delve into with ELT Under the Covers, because Rich's he's far more academic than me. I'm more of a, I'm not an advocate, but I help a lot more backpacker teachers. A lot of the stuff we do with Team Teacher China, we've got a whole bunch of PowerPoint lessons that people can just take and use instantly in the classroom. Mm. Because when you're teaching 50, 60 plus young students, it's a whole different ball game. And they come in, you know, wet behind the ears, completely green. And they just here to pay off their student loans, often with these teachers. Or what I found with online teachers is it's their second job. It's, you know, their choice was to drive Uber or to work for, you know, Happy Giraffe English online and just follow their teaching lesson plans. Yet what they do is they record, you know, their lessons and they give their advice and they grow huge YouTube channels and followings, because they get really popular because they're just a happy, nice, and very engaging social person. Yet they don't have time to do development as a teacher, and they probably don't feel that they need to. So it's kind of, with ELT Undercovers, we're trying to connect all of these worlds and all of these spectrums. So I think taking all of that into account going forward with teaching is going to be really interesting.
The role of teacher development and training,
especially
in the future,
and making it so that people want to go down that route or see a need to, is going to be interesting as well.
So we've had this format of CELTOR, CERT-TESOL, for years now.
Yeah,
the 4-week 120 hours, And it's gone online, and I'm sure it's, you know, I know it's a great course, but there's so many other ways that we could be doing things, maybe. I don't know. And is it relevant to somebody teaching 60 kids online in China? I doubt it.
Yeah, I mean, I've never taught a class of 60 kids. And I think... like Mr. K, when we asked him last week, didn't he? He said something like, you know, I think I could do it, but, you know, it wouldn't be without some apprehension, you know. And this is someone who's been in the industry for like 25 years and done all kinds of teacher training stuff. I think that's how I probably feel about it as well. I think I'd probably go into it and I would definitely have to have a long think about what the approach would be. And it would not be, you know, it would not be what I'm doing. The majority of teaching I'm doing now is one-to-one. And in fact, it's pretty much all one-to-one online.
But it's all part of that spectrum. We're all teachers, to different degrees, the different levels of qualification. And, you know, there's lots of arguments to be had about, you know, what makes a teacher to be a teacher. I think the point that I'm really getting at is that these people, if you've got a dip or you don't have a dip, you've got a weekend course or not even anything, you're just a happy-go-lucky person that just, you know, is doing a second job, you know, working VIP kids on the weekends, we're all in front of learners. So it kind of goes back earlier to what we were talking about, Nicola, where we're tools for the learners. So how can we be better tools, and how does that work now?
That's a good question. How can we kind of keep them at the centre of things?
Yes, how do we do that?
Yeah, I did find that interesting what you were saying about it. Like, it's because it became teacher-centric for a while because of the online thing and people looking at themselves. I mean, literally looking at you, you know, that's a challenge I find, you know, that like if you have your camera on, it becomes a little bit tricky. And, you know, I actually tend to have it off when I'm teaching now. I'd like not have my camera off, sorry, but have the kind of little mirror thing you can see of yourself. I have it off when I'm teaching because, you know, that's one way that you can sort of get rid of that distraction, which I think it is a distraction. So things like that, I think, are quite are definitely quite interesting. And also, you know, the idea that the learners have a lot more distractions as well. And and sort of dealing with that, you know, I teach a couple of teenagers, and like, you know, I can hear their WhatsApp kind of pinging off in the background, you know, but they are still engaging with the class. So, you know, because I'm there, I mean, they'd look a bit daft if I sort of said something to them and then they were just blank faced about it. So they are paying attention to the class. And I have so far, my approach has been not to make too much of a big deal of that. Because, you know, at the end of the day, I could say to them, hey, turn all that stuff off in the background. But there's no way I can actually verify it. They could just mute it. You know, there's a million and one ways. It's not like in the class where you can take their phone off them, is it? So there's sort of challenges like that as well. There's a lot of things, I think, that to be talked about that maybe are not quite being, haven't been discussed.
It's so new, I suppose. It was like a panic reaction, like I said before. It's like, oh, we need help. Okay, tech's going to be our savior. And that's kind of what happened. And then we kind of chilled out a little bit, calmed down and just refocused with the learners in the room. But it's not easy. I mean, we were doing assessments last year, and there were some students who were like on the beach with their mobile phone. And you know, the dip trainee teachers had put together these lovely lessons with kind of using Google Docs to do collaborative writing and stuff like that. And I was like, these guys are on their phone on the beach. So there was a lot of changing things in the middle of the lesson. And
so funny.
It's a bit of kind of negotiating that as well, isn't it? I guess it's sort of like, it's something you don't expect, then it comes up and you're like, oh, and then you kind of have to make some sort of decision about, well, you know, in future, are we going to say, you know, really you need to be attending the lessons on a laptop, or are we going to let that go and therefore the lessons need to have this kind of new dimension of differentiation where you might get a student with a mobile phone, you might get a student sitting at a desktop computer, you know, they might have a pen and paper, they might not.
There's no etiquette, is there? There's no established etiquette, sorry.
No. And there's a lot of kind of, it's got to be able to be done on a phone, really.
Yeah, because those, you know, computers tend to have more issues, or people have more issues with their computers because they're not used to it. So the phones are king.
I think there's a growing expectation as well to be able to do your English class anywhere on your phone.
Right, okay. That's really interesting because hasn't been my personal experience, but I guess it depends on sort of market of the learners, but definitely the platform, the people I've been working with, vast majority of students turn up on computers actually, or laptops, Macs, and then sometimes tablets, and then very rarely like someone will turn up on a phone. And I normally encourage them, like I say, you know, if you've got a device, like it'd be better if it's possible. If you have to do it on your phone, you can do it on your phone.
Yeah,
because I like to do a lot of kind of, you know, screen sharing and stuff. And, you know, it makes it, if you're kind of looking at stuff on your phone sometimes, you know, basically you have to design the materials in a completely different way if someone's looking at it on their phone. Because if they've got the whole screen, then obviously you can do readings and all kinds, right, with the screen. But then if they're looking at it on their phone, then perhaps it's going to be, you need this big text and, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it's also that... teachers have to take that into account. Do you know, when you're developing a website, you don't just develop the website for desktop, you develop it with mobile as well. You actually have two tracks, you know,
that's right.
And you have to make sure that everything is correct and in format on the desktop, and then also on the mobile, and or even when you're doing videos or YouTube or anything like that, when you're doing design, you've got to make sure that it works on the YouTube channel banner, Facebook banner, an iPad banner, everything. So you've got to take all that into account. So it depends. It's like, where's the onus? Is the onus on the teacher? Is it on the student? We're still working that out.
Yeah. But I think there's a lot of opportunities, and you know, I think publisher, I do a lot of writing as well for like teachers' books especially, mm-hmm. but also supplementary materials and other kind of stuff. And they're finally kind of making much more of a jump to having materials available kind of via slides and formats where people will be on a tablet or a laptop and learning online. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think until now, the kind of digitalization of course materials was kind of putting on a PDF that could be shown on an interactive whiteboard or displayed in class, and that was about it. But now they are, I mean, I'm seeing a lot more writing jobs, which are kind of, you know, they've got a digital platform. So I think if you are getting into, if you want to get into writing, that's kind of going to be your future, and being able to be aware of all those things and be able to write for those formats is really interesting and useful. I think we've all learned so much in the last year and a half that it's, you know, it's going to be helpful in the future.
And how do you do that now where, you know, where we're in the information age and there's already quite an extensive library of, you know, ELT resources and research? What do you write about now? You know, what can people bring to the table in your estimation?
Wow, that's a good question. I think that's quite an interesting focus for, and I was, since I've had that conversation with, since I had that conversation with Duncan, I've been thinking about that, like, what is the future? We're facing forward, but what is it? And I think there's like the near future, which is the kind of putting things more online, so course books, maybe developing so that you are a kind of, instead of writing worksheets and submitting, that's how I got into writing. I wrote some worksheets and submitted them to publishers. I wrote some stuff for teachingenglish.org.uk, you know, the British Council site. So instead of doing that and writing worksheets, you're writing stuff that can be interactive or that can be at least, you know, on a PowerPoint or shown in that kind of format. So if you want to get into writing, make sure that you're thinking about that.
Yeah.
And what was the other thing I was going to say? And then you've got all the questions about kind of teacher development as well. So you've got the kind of publishing side of it and writing materials, but then you've got writing about teaching and what you think is going to come in the near future and the kind of mid to long term future, which I think is moving towards like using VR, for example.
Yeah.
We're soon going to be in a world where there's instant translation going on. Mm-hmm. Like there's all these things that are coming into the mix that we need to confront and embrace and start thinking about. And like, what's our role in all of this?
Yeah.
If we want a job in 15 years, do we need to be knowing about virtual reality and writing for that?
Mm-hmm. Exactly, right.
And creating content for that. Yeah. Like, you know, there's a lot of exciting opportunities, but there's a lot of fear as well, like, oh my goodness, as soon as we have instant translators in our ears or in our glasses or wherever it is, you know.
Well, I think we've talked about that before as well. And when we were talking with Patrick Jackson, he was going to be doing a conference in Japan talking about the future, because he used to write a lot of course books, and he's got his own Pick-a-Pal thing going on right now, and I highly recommend, if you're watching this, to check out his video. Patrick is awesome and it's a very interesting interview. But one of the things that he talked about was even though we have these possibilities for translation, one thing that you can never ever take away, well, I should say never, is the cultural aspect. You know, he's very firmly believes people will want to come, students will still want to come to Ireland because they're going to want to experience the culture, the environment, the different way of life and approach. And he thinks that's going to be one of the driving forces going forward, that it's maybe not necessarily about learning English, but having an English experience in a way. What do you think about something like that?
Yeah, I think that that's true. And I think people are always going to want to go and be with other people as well, and maybe not have a mask on for all their language learning experience. Yeah, you'd get really dizzy. And B, you just kind of miss the human contact, wouldn't you? I think there's also that to consider, that even if all these things do happen, will we still just want to kind of be in a room or on a screen with other people? So I think that's true what he says, that people will want to have the cultural element, but they'll also just want the human element. That's my feeling on it anyway.
I think there's something to that, and I think even when we get that instant translation and we get the you know, the kind of the Google lady sort of speaking in your ear what that person's saying, it'd be very convenient, you know, to be able to communicate to people all over the world and have a fairly, I think the accuracy will probably be pretty good, maybe not perfect, but it's still, you're still sort of speaking to an AI, really. The person's there in front of you, but you're getting an AI translation. So you're not necessarily, you know, having exactly the same experience. So there is that different thing. And then there's kind of the idea that I think there's a lot of motivations why people take English classes. And I think actually that's been lost over the years, especially in English language teaching, because so many people, especially in Spain, you know, they do it because they have to do it. It's like, I need this for my job. And, you know, actually, you know, now, you know, doing what I do now, which is very international, you know, I actually get quite a lot of students who do it because they're interested and they, oh, I just want to improve my English for a bit. And, you know, and they enjoy elements of the class which aren't really that related to the English itself, although they're still learning English, and that makes it challenging, you know. So, you know, I think there is all that to be said. It's kind of like, you know, people still learn to play piano, even though you could just, I don't know, listen to whatever, someone else playing it or synthesize it on a computer or whatever, but people still do it.
Yeah, and get lessons exactly. In it, right? Yes. Yeah, it's interesting. My colleague, Mark McKinnon, I'll give a small plug to our pronunciation blog, which is just called teachpronunciation.blog. He works at one of the universities teaching English here in Barcelona, and the demographic of their students, even though it's associated with the university and they do have a lot of university students learning English to kind of do part of their degree in or just improve, they're already kind of reaching quite a good level by the time they get to university. So the demographics change from having a lot of young people and a few seniors, they call them, kind of over 50, would maybe question that senior label in that age bracket. Nearing that age myself. But he's now like 60 or 70% of the course, I think, last time they looked at it, was seniors. And they're just there to socialise. They've formed amazing communities. They go out for dinners. And they're definitely going for social reasons and just to kind of keep their minds active. And
yeah.
And to meet new people. So I think it's not to be underestimated, that kind of that reason for learning.
Yeah, definitely. Really nice, they can be some of the most fun classes, can't they? You know, it kind of, I mean, that kind of reminds me a little bit of like summer school with the teenagers, you know, because, you know, they're all kind of full of energy and fun and socializing with each other and in you know, visiting England or Scotland or wherever they go for their summer school. And you know, it's a big, you know, I used to love the energy of that environment. You know, it was something totally different, and it was very it was engaging for the teacher to be involved in all that, and they were all engaged with that sort of thing. And it was, you know, you can't, it's not because of the English teaching, really, is it? I mean, maybe hopefully that helped, provided some motivation. Maybe the at least it provided the motivation for their parents to put up the money. But you know, there's many other aspects that were motivating to the students themselves.
You carry on.
No, I was just saying that as part of that, that we wanted to kind of create a blog around like classroom experience. So at the start of the process, we did a load of team teaching. and we went in and kind of planned the lessons together. So we met, planned the lesson together, went in and taught the lesson together. And it never went to plan, but you know, and then afterwards we go and have a menu del dia and unpack it all. And it was so useful, the whole process. It was great. And we also recorded a lot of the learners. And so we taught these senior learners a lot. And we also got the students to kind of reflect on the experiences they've had. And there's a really good post called Tony Talks Prawn. And Mark interviews this Spanish learner in Spanish, talking about how having pronunciation more central to his learning really helped him. And he kind of goes into an amazing detail and talks about the different kinds of drilling that we did and how that helped him, and how using the phonemic script helped him, like, kind of unlock this code that helped him, you know, kind of understand how he had to move his mouth and everything. So I think it was a really positive experience. It's something I'd recommend to everyone, is doing that kind of team teaching if you can. And I think it's much easier now online. Even if you're in different locations, you can get together, plan your lesson, teach the lesson together, and then unpack it afterwards.
Well, you know, it's better to have like a more of a like a mastermind mindset, because you've just got so many different tracks of thought and approaches that you might not think about. It just makes sense to be part of almost a system rather than just one node. Since we're talking about prawn and pronunciation, I know you're a big fan, and you seem to be you've got the blog, and a lot of the clips that I see you teaching online are around prawn. How annoyed were you with the masks?
yeah, that makes it pretty hard, isn't it? I mean, I've not actually taught in a physical classroom having to wear them, so I can't. Oof. I've kind of seen teachers do it, and it's just, it looks awful. It looks really hard. But I think teachers are kind of getting used to it, and they're kind of now, you know, finding ways around it. And using visuals a lot more, and just moving back, pulling down the masks, articulating it and modeling it and moving back. And I think it's still there, but probably it's made people a bit more reluctant to do any drilling, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. But all jokes aside, what is it that draws you to pronunciation? Because it can be a bit of a Cinderella skill.
Maybe it was that. Maybe I think I studied English language and literature at university. So when I went to do the dip, I was kind of at an advantage because I'd studied all the phonemes and I'd done Scots language as well. So I'd done a bit of kind of analysis between English accents and Scottish accents and between Scottish accents. So maybe it was just something I was already kind of knowledgeable about. So therefore, I enjoyed that aspect of the diploma a bit more because it was more accessible. And maybe having a Scottish accent and kind of the frustrations and the celebrations around that of discovering that it was easier for Spanish people to understand most Scottish accents, not the really strong ones, but most of them, because we've got short vowel sounds as well. It's easier for me to learn Spanish for that reason as well. But there was a lot of frustration around the kind of standard accent being RP still, when it's only spoken by so few people. Having to kind of struggle to try and find the phonemic symbol that represented my accent so I could transcribe how I sound. And it was just, it kind of got me interested in a little bit more. And just talking to other teachers, I realised that it's quite a big part of our identity, our accent. And like I was telling you guys before, other teachers have felt quite judged and discriminated against even because of their accents. And that kind of got me interested in even more. And I really wanted as a teacher trainer to put it more at the heart of things, so more teachers became more confident to teach pronunciation. And when I was interviewing people to come on to the diploma course when I was course director, it was the main reason for people taking it. Or it was one of the most common reasons. So I think that kind of all also made me feel like a bit responsible as a teacher trainer to really do a good job on that part of the course.
Mm.
So there's a whole host of factors, really.
One
of the kind of reputation things, isn't it, that the dip has over the Delta, that a lot of people talk about the pronunciation focus on, I think the phonemic focus on both of the Trinity qualifications, actually. That's what I heard from people anyway. And that's actually why, I think that's one of the reasons why I kind of took it in the first place. Sorry, go on, Neil.
No, I was going to just say you had a lot of these teachers coming in that they're not so confident with the teaching pronunciation or just with around that area. How do you help them build that confidence? Do you have any sort of tips of, you know, kind of where to start if you're looking to, you know, jump into that area of teaching?
I'm just remembering now, I did a podcast with someone else about this.
Oh,
giving tips. So I think it's like anything. Once you are more knowledgeable about it, you feel more confident. So the first bit of advice is to go and read about it. There are tons of websites out there, blogs, books. It's like, you know, you got when you started teaching, maybe if you didn't learn English yourself, you just spoke English. Maybe you were you had to learn a lot about grammar. And then once you had the knowledge of how grammar works, you were much better at teaching it because you're more confident. It's the same with pronunciation. If you become more knowledgeable about phonology and how it works, then you'll be more confident to teach it. So even if you're not going to go into a diploma, I think just reading about it will give you that confidence.
Mm.
Putting the onus on the learners, I think there's part of the fear with pronunciation is that you become the center of the spotlight's on you,
mm-hmm.
and you're the main model and you're the kind of drill sergeant. So I think realizing that you don't have to teach pronunciation like that, like it isn't just drilling your student or students. There's lots of ways that you can get students to improve their pronunciation through more of a discovery process,
mm-hmm.
and you can design tasks which help them listen, and you know, mm-hmm. you can kind of show them the pronunciation and then get them to find it for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of like inductive grammar teaching, you can teach pronunciation like that, so you become less of the central focus. And getting learners to really kind of learn it for themselves, even, you know, go and watch this YouTube clip of this person teaching this pronunciation if you don't want to be the main model.
Mm.
And just observing other teachers if you can. There's loads of videos out there of teachers doing it really well. And then you can sort of practice it. And finally, just putting it into your lesson, like planning it and not waiting for it to come up. Because then you're really relying on a spontaneous reaction, and maybe you just don't do it because you're not confident about how to do it. So if you plan it and say, right, what am I teaching today? What language is there? What problems are my students going to have with this language in terms of pronunciation? Okay, I'm going to have a 5-6 minute slot in my lesson where I'm going to help them with that. How am I going to do it? And then you can go and look at the activities and kind of plan it so that you're prepared. And even if it doesn't happen in the lesson, at least you've gone through that process and you've prepared it and planned it, and you learn a bit more about how to teach it.
Yeah, totally.
Those are my tips.
I think there's a lot to be said for the self-discovery aspect, and even from a teacher standpoint, you know, the teachers experimenting themselves to be able to get to the bottom of, you know, how different sounds work. I remember when kind of I got to grips with the phonemic chart on the Celta kind of years before doing the dip, and I just kind of used that, you know, that was the sort of platonic you know, RP model, and you know, I kind of had an idea what the sounds were or whatever. But it wasn't until the dip that I started really experimenting with it. And I remember, I think it was an Adrian Underhill thing where he kind of encouraged that. He said, well, have a go and, you know, start paying attention. To start with, you're kind of like, what? The tongue's at the back, the mouth comes forward. Like, really, does it? You know, do the lips really do that? And you have to really, you know, it's like, it's much better if you start to just get a sense of what's going on yourself. And, you know, going between two sounds as well, I think helps a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, you're kind of like, oh, like, what am I actually doing to change those sounds? And I quite enjoyed that. You know, I quite enjoyed trying to work out what I was actually changing about my mouth to make those different sounds. And then when you have an understanding of it, or at least the process of it, then at least you can guide the students for that same process.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
We've spoken about prawn then.
No, it's really interesting. I was just thinking, you know, it's so I keep bringing this up. I don't know why, but the more that you kind of like you, the teaching path leads you to self-discovery, and you're always thinking about the language that you use. And when you're talking about phonics and phonemics, you're always thinking, oh, you're practicing and moving sounds around in your mouth. And then you're like, hold on. So this word is just these two sounds. So, but this word means this, and I'm communicating this, but it's just this, these two sounds here. And you start
to become a linguist, don't you?
Start becoming a linguist, but then you also start questioning your own reality. It's like, well, you know, well, this isn't just a word. It's just, you know, a couple of different sounds. You know, what's so special about this? And
yes,
you know, what am I doing? Who am I?
Yeah, and then you start doing it wrong as well. I've seen that before. Like,
you start
is that right? What's right?
You start getting the wandering accent syndrome.
Yeah.
And you end up copying your students rather than modeling them. Existential crisis through teaching.
The worst thing I've seen ever is this is such a surreal moment, but it actually happened. I didn't dream it. I don't think I dreamt it. We were teaching on a cert course, and we'd been explaining the kind of V sound to the trainees, and then getting them to kind of model it and peer teach and do some drilling. And, you know, it's like the lips touch the teeth. This trainee, it was so many years ago, and I'm really sorry if you are watching this, he started going this. He got upside down. We're like, are we seeing, is this really happening?
No, it's a
and
new
I don't
sound.
Think he was joking. I think he was actually I think he did a total brainstorm.
He just lost himself. He just went too deep.
First time you kind of
you never go full prom.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
It reminds me, actually, the thing that really, one of the skills that fed into language teaching for me was learning a language myself. I didn't grow up speaking any other languages, and I started learning Spanish when I was 27, you know, self-study. And then 6 months later, I was in Spain, like, putting it to use. And I think, like, I think it's, for me, it's, I wouldn't go as far as say it's critical, but I would say it would be something I would highly encourage any teacher to do. You should definitely have a go at, you know, you don't have to master a language or anything, but I think certainly like having a go at learning a few bits and bobs. And I think it's unfortunate, you know, if you're a language teacher and actually, you know, I'm not saying you have to speak another language, but, you know, have a go at learning a few bits and bobs and different pronunciation stuff, because you really start to understand you know, the kind of processes that students have to go through then. And also, especially when it comes to pronunciation, I think because you start to get an idea of, you know, how you actually have to change your mouth a bit. Mm-hmm. You can't just approximate the sounds all the time, because occasionally you're going to, you will come up against, you know, minimal purrs that don't exist in yours doing theirs or whatever. And you need to be able to understand how that process works of the awareness and the, you know, then moving on to practicing and whatever.
Just Didn't Scott Thornbury do a blog years ago about that, the defossilization diaries or something it was called? And he wanted to defossilize his Spanish. And I remember he did also, so it wasn't, for him, it wasn't just about the technical side of learning a language, it was the strategies. And so he did things like he went to class in a group. He had a few one-to-one classes. He gave a talk in Spanish at Oxford House, which I was very admiring. So it was sort of terrifying. And I went to it. I remember his talk, and it was all about the process. So it was a culmination. And he also did a language exchange with someone who taught Spanish and was a kind of professor at university, kind of similar level to Scott. So they met up and they would each read something and then talk about it as part of their language exchange. And he kind of then, he analysed all these different strategies and talked about what helped him most as a learner. So I think it was really interesting to hear him analyze all that. And he said that's the most useful thing he's done in his career. He said that I just strongly recommend that you learn a language and analyze your process.
Do you think
it informs useful. Your teaching, Rich? Like, you know, not informs as in you kind of know the pitfalls, but you know what works for you, so informs that, well, if this works for me, then there's got to be another person out there that it works. Maybe their brain works in a similar way. So if I teach, if I teach to myself, maybe I connect with someone that's got a similar sort of brain or learning way.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point about how it might work for me, but not necessarily for them. Yeah. I think that's totally true. I think, you know, learners, you have to really personalize things, don't you? And like, you know, for example, I actually, at the start, rather controversially, at the start of my Spanish learning, I had a lot of success with audiolingualism. I did a couple of audiolingual courses, an hour a day every day for 6 months, you know, just some MP3s or whatever. And it gave me the foundation, you know, and it was the most convenient and best thing for me at the time. And, you know, I know it did cause some problems later down the line because my Spanish was, you know, in the same way that Spanish people struggle with English and connected speech. I think my Spanish was very much, you know, word, rather than kind of phrase. But again, you know, on this subject, I think one of the things that convinced me more than anything about like the lexical approach and all this like teaching chunks and phrases and stuff is that I applied it to my own Spanish. And found that, you know, you just become so much more fluent and it feels so much better instead of trying to like piece your things together word by word. Suddenly, you know, you just throw these phrases out and you're like, wow, that's way better, you know? So definitely. And I think it gives you some conviction in what you're teaching as well, because you've applied it. So you're like, oh, I actually believe in this because it worked, you know? And I think the students can pick up on that. You know, you're not sort of selling them something that you've never, you know, hey, go to this island. I've never been there, but it's great. You know, instead you can say, yeah, I've been there. It is great.
Try this. Exactly.
Okay, Nicola, could you let us know what you're up to nowadays, today, or anything that's ruminating in that masterful brain of yours about English, the ELT sector?
Well, at the moment, I'm working for a Russian company called Practicum English, or English Practicum, at Yandex. They're a bit like kind of a big company, internet company in Russia. And we're creating an online learning platform with teachers. It's not all self-access stuff. It's not Duolingo, but it's just in its infancy. So it's very exciting because we're kind of thinking about how to build the syllabi and how to integrate all the different components and how to kind of make something that's really great for the learner. So I'm learning a lot of new things at the moment about managing that process and writing for that that kind of space. I'm also kind of thinking about starting a thing with a bit of a colleague. Well, we are starting it. I'm friends and neighbours with Kat Robb, who's kind of maybe known for EdTech and reflection with learners. She's done quite a lot of work with that, and also with IT in general, and kind of done stuff with robots and all sorts of things. But she does a lot of teaching on pre-sessionals and teacher training, and we've been thinking about the challenges that taking a higher level qualification can bring for in terms of writing and being a good writer. There's a lot of, I supervise all the Unit 2 projects, which are three action research projects on the diploma. And the process of writing is challenging for many different people, not just people who don't have English as their first language, and the whole, you know, from planning to writing to proofreading and to everything about it. So we're developing a service to help teachers and learners write better in that kind of writing your thesis or writing a research project or writing an article. And I've also been helping a teacher who did the dip a few years ago, and she's now working as a secondary teacher, and she's being assessed, or she's going through some kind of assessment process to move up a grade in her teaching, which involves writing a lot of lesson plans and huge long documents reflecting on the process. So I've been helping her with the writing of the lesson plans and giving feedback on those. So I think, yeah, we think that there's ways that we can create a community of tutors and learners, who sort of teachers and learners who want to improve their writing. So that's just in its infancy as well. That's kind of the things I'm working on at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a lot to unpack. How do you have time?
I've also, like, one of the big challenges of EdTech, I suppose, well, there's lots of challenges, isn't there? But one of the things I think that stands out is the engagement, isn't it? And I kind of wonder, like, what are your thoughts on how EdTech can be more engaging, or what kind of things do you do to try to make these online platforms more sort of that they actually draw students in and they actually, you know, do the things that... Mm-hmm. That need to be done, or that will benefit them, or whatever.
Well, our kind of main focus is not the tools. Again, it's the tools kind of come as a result of the intention, as it were. So the intentions are to create something which is personalized, but not that personalized in, well, we're going to make it look like it's personalized, but really you've just got option A or B. But to really kind of make a course which is not just kind of moving through a series of tasks, but creating something which is really personalized to the students' needs and wants. And the second thing is progress. I think a lot of people give up learning because they don't feel any progress, especially we're kind of looking at the B level students at the moment. Mm-hmm. And I think that particularly is a level where you've kind of got good enough to perform in most conversations, you can speak about most things,
yeah.
But it's limited, and you get frustrated because you don't feel the same speedy process as you do at the start. So we're trying to kind of think of how to really help students feel progress,
right.
And feel more confident. And there's a kind of, I think there's a thing in it, like the difference between completion and progress. Mm-hmm. You know, like when you do Duolingo or kind of a lot of,
right.
Which have really great features. There's a lot of onus on completion. Like, yes, I've done 5 minutes today, or I've done like 3 activities, or I've done this. And you get your gold stars and your badges. Mm-hmm. But is that progress? That's my big question. The question I'm asking myself at the moment is how are those things different?
Yeah.
Demonstrate progress. Yeah.
I experienced Duolingo when it first started. I used it a bit for Spanish, and I kind of thought, oh, it's just it's like what was that Rosetta Stone? It's like Rosetta Stone, but it's kind of online and free. And I didn't find it particularly useful. I went through the whole course. And then they had this thing where you translate web pages. And I think I enjoyed that a little bit more. That is learning like that, though, it's grammar translation method, right? It's like 100 years old, but, it was popular for a reason kind of thing. Anyway, did a bit of that. And anyway, I went back on about a year ago. I decided to start learning a bit of Japanese. And really, there's been a lot of innovation there. You know, it still has its limitations, obviously. And like you say, it's very much dangling the carrots, you know, come on, get your stars and get this and get that. But, you know, there's people on there. It's really interesting. There's a massive community on there. They've got these forums now. And you know, a lot of people who've kind of gone through lots of different languages. And there's examples of people who've done like the full course, having started at nothing, and then they've taken a language exam. And the general consensus is that a full Duolingo course takes you to about A2. So from nothing to A2, you know, with this kind of online thing, that's free, you know, it's not too bad. It kind of gives you a start. And, you know, there are all these kind of synthetic... The development head at the British Council used to call it Pavlovian motivation in sort of a negative way. She frowned upon it a little bit because there's this idea that, you know, but it should be the language itself which motivates. But I don't know. I think there's something to that as well. I think Pavlovian motivation has its place sometimes.
Well, we all like spend, or maybe not us, but our kids definitely, or my kid definitely spends a lot of time on TikTok and other social media, which is that kind of like, you know, get them back, and games. Her friend plays so many games online, so there is that kind of sense of completion is motivating.
Have you looked into that? Because, you know, with the Instagram and TikTok, well, not so much TikTok, but that, you know, there's that algorithm that, you know, picks up on what you keeps you engaged and then shows you more. And whenever I've heard of that, and, you know, from what you've just been talking about, I think, well, why wouldn't you try to apply that to language learning? You know, that you would have some sort of AI or algorithm that whatever they're interactive with in like a Duolingo kind of online edtech course thing, that it's more flexible in that what it is that they seem to engage with, they would present the language more in that style, you know, and that would be the personalization. So, oh, this person seems to like to watch the video, so we're going to show him more videos around this grammar point rather than audio, or we're going to connect him. Is this kind of the sort of thing that you're looking into as well?
It's not, but that's a really good point. Yeah, that you can personalize the modes.
Use it for good, not for evil.
But the stuff I'm working on isn't kind of fully automated. It's with teachers, and it's kind of developing materials and resources that they can use to kind of give a really good experience. But there is going to be that kind of, there is that component as well, which is kind of the self-access as on all platforms. And I think if you can personalize the mode of how students hear and see the language and how they practice it, and they can kind of choose their favorite ways as well, that's going to be positive. So it's all new to me at the moment. But it's quite exciting to learn something different.
And that definitely ties into my thoughts on sustainable improvement. I think it's something I always kind of speak about with my students, especially when they're kind of new, when they're just starting with me. Is because you get the questions, don't you, about what should I do? What can I do to improve my English? What should I do? Should I read? What books can you recommend? And then, you know, you might say to them, well, what do you like reading in your own language? I don't like reading. Oh, you don't like reading? Well, you think you're going to enjoy reading in English then if you don't like reading, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a big thing about, it's if you want it to be sustainable, then it has to be something that's, I think, has to be something that you enjoy or you find relaxing. or there's some positive element like that. If it's like you know, hammering a pickaxe on a lump of stone, then you might be able to do it for about 3 weeks, but then that's not enough to learn a language.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you enjoyed the kind of the longer bits of text, not the little kind of bits of phrases and the gamification of it all.
Yeah, or whatever the person enjoys, you know. Yeah, if you enjoy playing video games, well, there's plenty of video games I can recommend you, and you can put them all in English. You know, you know, if you enjoy watching TV series, then which exactly? And there's so many options now with series and YouTube and things where you can. It's very easy to get the subtitles. You can often slow down the production of the audio production to like 75% if you need a bit of help with the comprehension side of it. You know, there's all kinds you can do.
There's a really good app, EWA, that my students use that that does that sort of thing for them. You know, you'll have clips from, you know, Friends, and it slows it down, and it has all the scripts, and so you can watch the video as it's automatically going through the scripts, and you can click on the, you know, the phrases or certain words, and it'll pop up with like an explanation for them and stuff like that. It's pretty nice. Decent, and that was free.
Even better.
Yeah.
Yes, there's so many tools out there.
So I was thinking that maybe this would be a good opportunity to sort of wrap this up. But before we do that, we'll Rich and myself will just, you know, talk about what we've been got going on. So if you're interested to find more of my stuff, I've got teamteacherchina.com. That's where we've got all our PowerPoints that you can download, use instantly in the classroom. Those PowerPoints have been turned into videos, and they're on the YouTube channel Team Teacher English, so you can kind of give those to your students and as homework or a little bit of self-study. And then we also have Team Teacher Baby, where it's myself using my skills as a teacher in my parenting, or just watching the disaster that's going on there.
To program your child to be exactly as how you want him to be.
That's a bit Orwellian, but kind of close to what I'm doing. And then Professor Rich.
YouTube.com/Professor Rich. Weekly live streams at the moment. There you go. That's all I got right now. I want to be able to plug more stuff, but that's what I'm doing.
Okay. And thank you so much, Nicola, for coming on. It's been really fantastic and interesting speaking with you. But I'm going to give you the final thoughts, if you want to share some final thoughts with us, or any links to some ongoing projects or something that you've got going on. Please, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you so much. That was really interesting, and took us, we went in directions I hadn't expected, so it's a really nice chat. In terms of sharing links, I suppose the blog is the kind of most useful for teachers, the pronunciation blog. The other writing project that I'm working on is going to be called How to Write originally, but it's not really launched yet. It's still in the planning stages. And yeah, there's lots of information out there about the diploma as well, if you want to take a look at Oxford TEFL's website.
What was the address for the pronunciation blog?
It's just teachpronunciation.blog.
Okay. Fantastic.
And yeah, the diploma, it's Oxford TEFL in Barcelona, but they have centres in other places as well. So get in touch if you want some information about that.
Wonderful. And we'll put all the links to what Nicola has mentioned below in the description box and in the comments, so you can instantly get access to those and, you know, up your teacher game, so to speak.